Hello, everyone. Today we're going to be looking at the arguments of Robert Filmer for monarchy as laid out in his 1680 book, Petrarchia. This, fact fans, makes Filmer the current record holder for the earliest figure to be included in my Great Thinker series. The previous record holder was Thomas Carlyle. Now, why am I discussing Filmer? Surely this old book, Petrarchia, has been thoroughly dealt with by liberal theory, by John Locke. And in this video, I'm going to argue that even though on the face of it, it looks like Locke spent a long time refuting the arguments of Filmer, if you go back to the two treatises, he actually spends most of his time not really dealing with the core argument, and instead kind of making childish, sarcastic, kind of snide attacks at his Christian fundamentalism, which is admittedly rather off-putting for modern readers of Petrarchia. But this, I'm going to argue, is actually peripheral to the argument that he makes. Now, here at the academic agency, I sell a course called Foundations of Logic. You should buy it now. Everybody should buy Foundations of Logic. And you too will be able to make assessments like this. What Filmer does that I find very interesting in this book, and arguably stronger than the argument for monarchy that Thomas Hobbes gives — I will cover Thomas Hobbes tomorrow, I also have an older video on Hobbes — is that, well, there's two things. Firstly, Filmer goes back to first principles, and he insists on the argumentation being rational, okay? And he builds up his argument from first principles onward, okay? That's the first thing that Filmer does. He's very rigorous, actually, okay? Yeah, we can, yeah, he mentions Adam in the Bible, yeah, fine, okay? We can deal with that, and I will deal with it going forward. Second, what I'm going to argue is it is not actually essential to his argument. We can replace the Bible with Darwin, right, if you want. But I'll get to that in a second. The second thing, and by the way, this is an introduction to, you know, the 10 points. If I find someone doing that, timestamp 7 minutes if you want to start the video. Look, these introductions are important. So if I find you doing that, not only will your comment be deleted, but you shall be banned. I've noticed people doing that before. These introductions that I give set up the topic. It's not some like appendage that you can take off. I'm setting up the topic. I'm explaining why film is important. I'm explaining some really important things in the history of political thought. So don't fast forward. Anyway, let's continue. So the first thing is rational argumentation and his logic. The second thing is that Filmer insists on empirical evidence, and his approach is actually empirical, quote unquote, which is interesting because John Locke claims to be empirical, but in fact is not. So you could say he uses facts and logic, Filmer does, whereas Locke really doesn't, which is ironic considering that John Locke is the poster boy of modern day liberalism and said to be the father of modern liberalism. In most history books, their history of liberalism will start with John Locke. And in fact, in my Defenders of Liberty, I actually wanted to redress this a little bit, because I start my history of liberalism with Niccolo Machiavelli. That is a discussion for another day. Maybe one day I will get to Machiavelli and why I think really you need to start the history of liberalism with him. And indeed, Hobbes, who does have a kind of proto-liberalism in his thinking, as we'll see tomorrow. Okay, let's get back to now. Well, let's start the lecture at hand properly. Now, when people talk about the patriarchy, quote unquote, seldom are they talking about anyone who like kind of actually wrote a book defending the quote unquote patriarchy. But Robert Filmer actually did. His book is called Petrarchia, and he literally advances an explicitly patriarchal theory of monarchical power, which I will now explain. Now, he basically develops, over the course of this book, 10 arguments against social contract theory, okay, against liberal thinkers like Locke. We start with the origins of authority. Then we move on to the foundations of obligation as they actually played out in history. And then we have a look at the political consequences of abandoning the framework, the patriarchy or the patriarchia. So the starting point for Filmer is that patriarchal authority is the original form of government. Okay. Now, if you actually read it, he goes back to Genesis in the Bible. He goes back to Adam, and he takes that as the historical starting point, which was then mocked by John Locke. Okay. The fact that he uses that as an example is neither here nor there. Okay. Now, this is important in the interest of intellectual activity. You need to show somebody that you're reading intellectual charity. Okay. Let's pretend that it's not Adam. Okay. Let's pretend it's Grug in his cave. You know, the archetypal caveman with his woman and his children there with his club. Okay. 2001 Space Odyssey. Or you can take actual historical examples of, for example, Germanic tribal structure as it existed, you know, in historic Europe. Or you can have a look at, the early Romans, as various people have done. There's a book that's sold by Imperium Press called The Ancient City that does this. And broadly speaking, as an empirical fact, most forms of authority in historic, in the historical record have been patriarchal. It starts with the father as the protector and the governor of the family. And then political authority grows organically from the original domestic rule. Hopefully you can see, you can disaggregate his example, which is Adam from the Bible, from the point that he's trying to make. The point is it starts with the father, the family structure, and therefore power starts with the father. And you know, from there, if you can imagine, what's the next biggest thing from a family? It's the tribe. And it then therefore is a tribal leader, a chieftain, often a patriarchal, if not always, a patriarchal figure in this way. Now, feminists of various kinds and people like Friedrich Engels will say, yeah, but what about this little matriarchal tribe that we found, you know, in somewhere in Africa, or what about this, you know, in Papua New Guinea or something? Okay, what about this obscure tribe we found, which actually has a matriarchal structure? And I'm pretty sure Robert Filmer would say, yeah, but they didn't get anywhere. They didn't make any advancements. They didn't develop into states. They didn't develop into empires. They didn't build any civilizations. So those ones are neither here nor there. If you want to look in a pure evolutionary sense, they're the ones that didn't survive, or didn't develop, or didn't, you know, they just kind of, you know, fell by the wayside of history, if you want to put it that way. Whereas, of course, all of the known civilizations that have thrived have been patriarchal in nature. Now, I don't want to get too sidetracked on the gender issue. That was a couple of weeks ago when I was talking about Otto Weininger and so on and so forth. But it is basically a fact what he's saying. And to get caught up in this example or that example, or, you know, the fact that he uses Adam from the Bible or this little matriarchal tribe there, is actually quibbling around the edges. And unfortunately, this is really what John Locke does quite a lot in Two Treatises. He quibbles around the edges. He doesn't engage with the substance of the argument, which is, where is authority from in the first place? From whence does it derive? And his argument is it derives fundamentally from the fact of fatherhood, and this being central to the survival of the family and by extension the tribe and by extension the kingdom or the nation beyond that. Now, why this is extremely important is because if you know anything about John Locke, his starting point is something called the state of nature. And Filmer's starting point is the state of nature simply did not exist. As an empirical fact, there was never a time at any moment in history where there was this, you know, people just quote unquote living in nature. All known societies begin with authority already established, typically in the form of paternal or kingly rule. The contract, the social contract, that is a scholarly fiction, an abstraction in contrast to the actual historical record. And this is a big frustration of Filmer's, because he's like, oh, these liberals coming along, they're just making this up. Where have they pulled this social contract idea from, where all the people get together and make some sort of, oh yes, we agree to live under, this didn't happen. It's almost like when Althusser said there is no outside of ideology, there is no outside of political structure, there is no outside of power, there is no before politics. And this is important because I've talked a lot on this channel about elite theory. The central foundational premise of elite theory is that the human being is the political animal. That there was never an outside of this. There was never an outside of power, never an outside of politics. Politics is always already and comes prior. So let's go back to Grug the caveman. Okay, again, we're imagining, right, this caveman in his tribe. Did we imagine that they didn't have politics, that they didn't have hierarchy, that they didn't have forms of codes of law and forms of rule? Of course they did. Of course they, and they had rituals and customs and ceremonies. Of course they did. Anybody who studied any even rudimentary part of anthropological history will tell you that there was never a time where people were just living in this mythical state of nature, where people were free and equal. That just didn't happen. Didn't happen. We'll address Thomas Hobbes's state of nature tomorrow. But this is where Filmer's interesting, because where Hobbes concedes the point, Filmer just won't, he just won't concede the initial premise. He denies the premise. And Foundations of Logic fans, this is one of the ways to argue. You can attack the validity of an argument, you know, does it follow in the logical chain of reasoning? You can quibble with definitions, okay? You can say, well, you haven't defined this, the precision of the definition. That's another way. But one of the chief ways is by denying the premise. And what Filmer is doing is he's saying that the entire edifice of modern liberalism is built on a faulty assumption. It is built on a false premise, namely that the state of nature does not exist, or that the state of nature was ever a thing, and therefore that the social contract was ever a thing. The state of nature didn't exist, and therefore there is no social contract. Very interesting that Filmer made this move right at the start. So before I go on to John Locke, how is it that history records that Filmer lost this argument with Locke? Which he didn't, by the way. But how does history record that Locke won this encounter with Filmer? Well, there was a political victory for the liberals in the Glorious Revolution of 1688. That is the coming of William of Orange, history fans. They simply had a political victory and then declared the argument won and acted as if Locke had won. Which is, if you think about it, what liberalism has almost always done throughout history. It wins either a political victory or a military victory, and then acts like it has won some debate. Actually, it has won almost no debates at all. It just does this. You can go forward. It did the same thing, arguably, after the French Revolution, where Napoleon, by sword, conquered most of Europe and, you know, declared it liberal at sword point or at gunpoint. It did the same thing after the two world wars. It didn't win. It didn't win any debates. There is no debate club theory of history where outcomes are decided by these sorts of things. Outcomes are decided by the gun, the sword, by politics. So this is one of the things that people have to bear in mind. That, you know, because I think it's one of the great injustices in the history of ideas that Filmer is seen as the guy who lost to Locke, when Filmer demolishes Locke. He demolishes it on the merits. If you're into argumentation or political theory or evidence and facts and things like that, Filmer demolishes Locke. And yet, in the kind of shorthand version of history, Locke is seen as the victor. Why? Because of the Glorious Revolution. Anyway, against Locke's state of nature, Filmer posited that there had never existed a condition of natural freedom and equality prior to government. So in other words, there's always been power, there's always been hierarchy, there's always been inequality. There's never been a time where you got this, you know, hippy-dippy state of the state of nature. Later adopted by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, of course. We are born into families. We are born under authority. The Lockean state of nature is an abstract invention deployed to justify resistance to rightful rulers. He argues that if legitimate government required the personal consent of every individual, no stable government could ever exist. Most people never explicitly consent to be governed. And you can test this out. Were you asked? I just happened to be born in a little town in Wales in the 80s. I didn't ask to be born. I also didn't ask to live under, you know, quote unquote, liberal democracy. I didn't ask. Were you ever asked? I was never asked. Most people do not consent to anything. There is this social contract. It's just nonsense. It just is. It just has. Like, we're born into it. The concept of tacit consent, according to Filmer, is too vague, too elastic to serve as a genuine foundation for authority. Political obligation, according to Filmer, must rest on something more durable than shifting individual wills. Something that lasts, something that has stood for a long time, something that can't like arbitrarily just be ripped up just because, you know, we've changed our minds or something. Filmer anticipates later critiques of Locke, notably Hume's essay of the original contract by decade. So these arguments that Filmer made were later made by David Hume and various later theorists and praised and so on. Yet Filmer stated them here right at the very start. In my opinion, he just blows a hole straight through Locke, and from which Locke can't really recover if you consider facts and logic to be important. I'll just get myself out of the way here. He says that children are born under parental authority, and this is an observable fact. And all of this, as I've mentioned, is foundational to political order. Whereas abstract equality is a theoretical construct with no historical basis, artificially imposed doctrine, basically just made up by John Locke. Filmer grounded his argument less in pure theology than in the observable record of human societies. Everywhere and always, authority precedes consent. The patriarchal model, he contended, fits the historical evidence far more faithfully than the theories of original equality and voluntary contract. Political equality is a late and artificial doctrine imposed upon a fundamentally hierarchical reality rather than the natural starting point. And in Filmer's view, look, you can try to act like these things are true, you can try to impose it on people, but there's a basic kind of underlying reality there that's always going to try to reassert itself. Because this thing, this abstract equality, is simply made up by Locke. And this is why, everywhere and always, the fundamental enemy of liberalism is reality. Because liberalism must invent fictions to justify itself. Property and authority are linked. Just as a father governs and disposes of the resources of his household, a king holds ultimate authority over the realm, including its property. The domestic and political orders mirror one another. Now, if any of you are a homeowner, okay, if you own your own home, you have an incentive to look after that home. Versus people who rent, or people who live in social housing, for example, who have less of an incentive to look after those things. I would say it's a sliding scale. If you're a long-term renter, you know, you may have some pride in that home. If you're a kind of, you know, moving from place to place and you don't really care about those things, you may have less, you know, somebody else's problem to deal with, which is one of the explanations for why areas with housing projects and council estates tend to be more run down and less well looked after than areas of 100% homeowners, who are more likely to just get a go and paint the fence themselves, or mow the grass, or, you know, take their rubbish out, or look after, you know, do the basics. Why? It's because the homeowner is like a milk monitor. It's like a little monitor of his own domain. And what Filmer is saying is, so with the homeowner here, so with the king. Only the king's lands are a lot bigger than just your house. But because of that, he has a permanent incentive to look after it. He has a permanent incentive to care about the welfare of the nation, because he has such an investment in it, because it's his. So just like a father has a permanent incentive to take care of his wife and his family, so the king has a permanent incentive to look after the kingdom as his kind of wider family. Attempts to separate individual property rights from political authority, as John Locke does, produce an unstable dualism. Filmer saw no coherent basis for allowing subjects to hold property independent of the sovereign's ultimate dominion. So, let's just say the king is the ultimate owner of the land. He basically then can almost kind of sublet or lease that land to you. Okay, you can say, well, for a period of this amount of time, this land is yours. We're parceled out by my authority. So you own this property, Duke or Earl or whoever, you own this as a result of my sanction. And Locke, because Locke was for property as well, property rights, of course. He wanted to disaggregate the king's authority. He wanted to assert property rights as a right in and of itself, prior to and separate from the kind of monarchical rights. Kind of an interesting argument. What is particularly interesting to me is that if you have a look at the history of concept known as eminent domain, It wasn't really that long after Locke and his friends took over that they basically reasserted the monarchical privilege of being able to confiscate lands for themselves. So it's not like this principle that Filmer is talking about didn't reassert itself. The monarchical principle of where authority derives was not actually overturned by liberalism. Because the fact is, there is no absolute property right, even in America or even in this country. Now you'd think, oh, come on, hold on, I own my house here. Fact is, the government can come along anytime. If they want to build a road there, they can say there's eminent domain and it's in the public interest. You've got to sell up. You've got to get out of here. Every country in the world, including, incidentally, libertarian paradises such as Singapore, where the government owns all of the land. And it's in exactly the same way as Filmer was talking about, basically leased out. But it can be taken away at any time because you don't own that land by some kind of magical right. You own that land because the government says you can have it, because the king says you can have it. And again, I hope you can get to the root of the disagreement here. The root of the disagreement is not over the right to own property, like property, you know, should you be able to own a house? The argument is over, should the government have ultimate say-so over whether a person can own this bit of land or own that bit of land? And ultimately, in Filmer's argument, the authority to own that is derived from the king. And in the post-Lockean order, the authority is still derived from the government, only you've stripped out the patriarchal, divine element from it. It is now by the, as Herbert Spencer would later say, the quote-unquote divine right of Parliament. So somebody is still exercising the monarchical right and the monarchical power. They're just doing it through the mechanism of Parliament or Congress or whatever else. Reality has actually reasserted itself on this. That's going to upset a lot of libertarians, and I am dealing with Hopper, Hans Hermann Hopper, later in the week, by the way. But anyway, eighth point: resistance theory undermines order. Once it is accepted that people may judge and resist their ruler on the basis of supposed original contract, every government becomes provisional. Filmer regarded this as a recipe for permanent instability and civil conflict. A prescient concern given the upheaval of the English Civil War that shaped his era, but also if we fast forward it to now, look at the amount of civil conflict produced by democracy, which, as per Carl Schmitt, becomes a kind of war, a warring of the groups. It becomes, this special interest and that special interest and this group and that group all pitting their quote-unquote rights against each other. Of course it's going to disintegrate. Of course it's going to reduce social and political cohesion. Of course it is. And Filmer, you could argue, in the very long run, predicted all of that. If the people are the final arbiters of whether a ruler has kept this or that contract, revolution becomes a perpetual possibility. Of course, Filmer was not to know how devious and cunning the managerial state would become under liberal democracy, making revolution almost impossible. But that's a story for another day. You can watch my videos in the last several weeks to see what I'm talking about there. Filmer argues that stable authority requires an origin beyond the popular will, one that is not susceptible to revision by each new generation. because one generation of people can do an awful lot of damage. Isn't that right, baby boomers? They can get all sorts of hip and trendy new ideas into their heads, and they can, you know, rewrite every rule. And to quote Shakespeare, hark what discord follows. Filmer saw this coming. Because instead of something that, you know, is kind of stable and immovable as the basis and the bedrock of authority, you have such fickle things as quote-unquote values. Well, values can change, or laws can change, or constitution can change. Later in this week, I'm going to be looking at Joseph de Maistre, who, again, rips all of these ideas to shreds. Very interesting. He argues that scripture and nature reinforce each other. Filmer drew on a lot of biblical material in making his arguments. I think that John Locke incorrectly mistakes the biblical material for the crux of the argument, or for the argument itself. Actually, they're an irrelevance, if you ask me. But, you know, he looks at the dominion of Adam, and then he uses how families develop in the Bible as the basis of his kind of empirical fact. Okay. You can just replace all of that with evolutionary psychology, for example, with Darwin, or with any, or with modern anthropology, whatever you want, or without just an account of history. You don't really need the biblical stuff. But anyway, it is treated that his whole purpose of using the Bible is that this scripture is consistent with the natural and historical pattern of authority, rather than as a kind of religious dogma. It's not that Filmer was drawing on that material to, you know, be some sort of Christian fundamentalist. The reason he lent on it is because he thought those things were an historical fact. But he can say, well, his facts were wrong because the Bible's not true. Okay, all right, fine. But let's find the fact. Let's see what the facts actually are then. And the facts actually are something closer to what is discussed in the Bible, funny enough. The theological argument supports and corroborates the empirical argument. It does not replace it. Scripture confirms what observation already reveals, that authority, hierarchy, and paternal governance are universal features of human life. Filmer finally asserts the superior realism of patriarchal theory. His account confronts the fact of human dependence, natural hierarchy, and the necessity of clear authority more honestly than any contract theory. Locke's system may be elegant in the abstract. I would argue it's quite messy in the abstract. I don't think Locke is good at anything, really. I don't think he's good at empirical evidence or logical argumentation. But anyway, let's just grant it that it's elegant in the abstract. But it remains untethered from how political life actually began in history, and endures across generations. Filmer prioritizes fidelity to political reality over philosophical neatness, which is ironic given that Locke is held as the banner boy for English empiricism. There's nothing empirical in Locke at all. A methodological stance that anticipates later conservative thought. So, Filmer's legacy is, first, his challenge to liberalism, showing that it's basically built on a pyramid of lies, of complete fictions. Secondly, that the hierarchy he wishes to defend, whether you like it or not, or whether liberals like it or not, is empirically rooted. This is actually not only how one society developed, but pretty much all of them that we know about. Developed being the operative word, by the way. If you can care to name some matriarchal societies, they didn't develop, they just stayed the same. Second, authority is seen as something that is natural and not contractual. Third, Filmer, like the very fact that Locke and various later theorists kept on coming back to Filmer and trying to take him on, shows that they were clearly rattled by something that he was saying. I argue that they never really dealt with him, and that even liberals to this day have never adequately dealt with the arguments I've put forth here, and more arguments than that even, that Filmer outlines in Petrarchia. So, yeah, I think Filmer is somebody worth reading today. I think he's someone who is unfairly dismissed in the mainstream of political theory, or seen as kind of like some like dinosaur that was dealt crushing blows by John Locke. It just didn't happen. So this video is my small way of addressing it. You should pick it up and read it. If you haven't, pick up a course at the academic agency, Foundations of Logic, people. Filmer would have absolutely smashed Foundations of Logic. Locke, maybe he wouldn't have passed, you know. Maybe John Locke would not have been able to pass Foundations of Logic. Because you have to get 100% to pass the course. Anyway, I'll see you all tomorrow. Get out.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.